At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Mrs. Davis, Season 1, Episode 5 is over, but we have to go back down the Hidden Access Technical Camouflage Hideout here on Post-Show Recaps. Previously recapping Lost, currently recapping Mrs. Davis, Season 1, Episode 5, A Great Place to Drink to Gain Control of Your Drink. Hello, everybody. Mike Bloom here. Drinks on me as we are talking about a big episode of Mrs. Davis. I know they said thou shall not sip, but we took a big gulp of exposition this episode as we sit down to hear a tale about a woman with a head of fiery red hair who ends up with her head red in a very different way by the end. Of course, I am not alone. I am joined by someone who may or may not have been a sister of the coin this entire time, Joe Garfine.
Well, you know, I do like a pinstripe suit, Mike. So I'm just saying it. I'm a stealthy lady of the coin.
Yeah, well, not so stealthy now, though. Again, they're, you know, doing dances to the moon at the shores of Lox, so they're not necessarily as, you know, behind the scenes maybe as they want to be.
I'm not good enough at math to be a banker, let's be honest.
I mean, I don't know if they're bankers either, though. They just said it's a big front. I don't know if they're even doing any banking.
That's true. I mean, are they sitting at the, you know, at the till every day and doling out cash and then going at the night being superhero banker ladies? I don't know. But I will tell you that I was delighted by this episode overall. We not only got answers, we got more questions, but we also, I feel like it was very enlightening.
Oh, yeah, 100%, as we find out a lot about the story of this mysterious Clara, who has been sort of like the MacGuffin, ensconcing the MacGuffin in the form of this grail for the past four episodes. We get to see the relation to another character who we met in one of the first scenes of this opening episode, who hasn't really come to the forefront at all this season aside from that, and Dr. Arthur Schrodinger. It was a, as I said before, massive episode that I think helps, you know, the people who feel like there are too many questions get the majority of answers. Well, also, to your point, I think still giving a dose of those questions that has us questioning certainly events that have happened in the past and certainly makes us wonder where the hell we're going in the future.
Yeah, I don't know, but I kind of love that I don't know. I hate when I can predict what's happening on a television show. This is certainly not the case with Mrs. Davis. It is that mind-blowing emoji, like, every time I watch that episode.
Well, in more ways than one in this episode. So, Josh Wigler is unfortunately in abstention. No word yet as to whether he is in the belly of a sperm whale or not, but you will be hearing from him on a Mrs. Davis podcast this week, just not this one, as Josh is going to have a very special podcast coming up early next week. He'll be talking with Owen Harris, who was the director of this episode of Mrs. Davis, as well as the first two. I think that makes a lot of sense now in retrospect, given how much the opening couple of scenes of the series now connect back to episode 5. I'm sure picking the brain of anyone who works on this absolutely delightful wackadoo show is going to be so much fun. So I really look forward to hearing Josh and Owen's conversation later on this week.
Yeah, and I would be curious, and I hope Josh asks him, and I'm sure he will because he's Josh, that, you know, if they filmed sequentially, if they filmed what we saw last night, it makes sense that they would have done that early on and gotten that B-roll for this episode.
Imagine we're jumping around timelines and locations enough and then having to film it out of order where, okay, you're finding out this information, Betty Gilpin, but now we're actually going to go to Vatican City and you have to pretend that you don't know that information as you view the commercial.
You never know in the wonderful world of Hollywood, Mike. You just never know.
Very true. And we go Hollywood this week as we find the origin point of the infamous shoe commercial that turned out to be our cold open of the series. Of course, we have new episodes of Mrs. Davis coming out every week on Peacock, and summarily, we will have recaps going on. This is a very fun podcast for you and I as well, Joe, considering this is the first podcast we are doing about Mrs. Davis since the first four episodes have released to everybody.
Right.
So we certainly have some feedback to get to from people. You can always email us your feedback down the hatch at postshowrecaps.com. Or if you're a patron of Post Show Recaps, which you can become a patron of at patreon.com/postshowrecaps for access to not only ad-free versions of this podcast and much more, as well as access to our own secret circle, if you will, the siblings of the coin, those who offer up coin in the form of a patron subscription, the Discord, where there has certainly been a lot of discourse about this show so far. It has been so much fun to watch people's real-time reactions over the course of four episodes so soon after the three of us creating opinions and promptly demolishing it and then building back up again. I know the Holy Grail seems to be, you know, undestroyable, but certainly our guesses about what's going to happen on this show are very much capable of being imploded. So we have some feedback to get to there as well, but it seems like, Joe, maybe I'm just frequenting the right corners of the internet, but it seems like things are good. People are liking Mrs. Davis.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, about once a week since we started, I have checked the hashtag Mrs. Davis on Twitter, which is always sort of a litmus test of what people are talking about. And a lot of people seem confounded, but also already invested. And they're like, I don't know what I'm watching, but I can't stop watching it, which I think is an excellent sign for the life of this show.
Yeah, 100%. I know that Tara and Damon have obviously given a slew of interviews about their thoughts on the first half of the season. And they said, you know, the door at this moment does remain closed. These eight episodes are a self-contained story. At the same time, we would love to do a season two if it's possible. So hopefully enough eyes get on this so we have more doors to peek behind for seasons to come.
It seems like the kind of show that's going to be a cult classic, that's going to grow, that once people watch all eight episodes, that word of mouth is going to spread, also depending on how they wrap this up, this eight episode, run, if it is viral worthy. I mean, something crazy could happen, which everything crazy does happen in every episode. So I'm not sure how they can maximize that. But I feel like if this is an eight episode run that really hits with the right amount of people who talk about it, other people will start watching it. And maybe Peacock will make their decision based on that.
Otherwise, outside of all of that, as we're getting through Mrs. Davis season one, we want your ratings and reviews. You can go to postshowrecaps.com/DTH, postshowrecaps.com/Westworld, as well as postshowrecaps.com/Davis. That last one, very important. This is our new Mrs. Davis feed, and we want to get any and all eyes to Joe's point on this show, and particularly on the podcast recapping this show. So if you leave any ratings and reviews, that is incredibly important. The sister of the coin may try to be clandestine, but we want to be out in front. So any ratings and reviews are greatly appreciated. Let's get into it, Joe. This is season one, episode five, A Great Place to Drink to Gain Control of Your Drink. Now, I know that we have the whole like AI generated titles. I gotta say, of the five we have had so far, this title feels the most applicable to the plot of the episode.
I've never used the AI chatbot, admittedly, so I don't know how it works, but I wonder if they put in one keyword, because they do drink from the grail in this one. So I wonder if they put in drink or imbibe or something just to sort of set it off, because you're right, it's very on the nose.
Yeah, it could be something where maybe they just got 8 to 10 randomly generated phrases and tried to match it up as much as possible. And so this is the one that's going to be the most equivalent. I'm not entirely sure. Next episode's called Allison Treasures, A Southern California Story. So who knows? This might knock this episode out of the park, and we're going to meet an entirely new character in the sixth episode of an 8-episode season.
You said Alice?
Allison.
Oh, I was like, ooh, Alice in Wonderland. That's immediately where my brain went.
Well, let's go to a very different topsy-turvy place besides Wonderland, as most of this episode is going to be pretty streamlined, or I guess lake-lined, in the form of focusing on the story Schrodinger is telling Wiley and Simone, while also dealing with the flashbacks behind how Clara ends up in possession of the Grail. But we start things on a bit of a different note. We stop in at Jay's restaurant in disrepair, would be putting it mildly. Right? Simone is going to, I guess, check in with her boo while she's on this Zodiac raft to the island to meet with Schrodinger. She's wearing that fun red life vest as well. But she finds that Jay is significantly roughed up. He kind of shakes off the identity of who it was. And as we sort of found out last episode, when the Pope told his story, the restaurant is not just a meeting place for Jay's lovers. It does kind of seem like the place everyone goes when they try to summon Jesus. And in this case, Jesus happened to run into somebody who was not a big fan of his.
Who on God's green earth has the power to beat up JC? You know what I'm saying? Or is allowed to, in a sense. Like, if the quote big guy, the man behind the curtain, who I think is not a man, God behind the door allowed it to happen. He's right there. They're right there.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. There is part of a mind for me, not to flash to the end of this episode, but I got to imagine we're not done with Clara. Like, I think she still is alive. She exists somewhere. Just because you blow up a woman's head, we see someone who got their head removed in the first episode only for it to turn out to be a magic trick. This is a very different type of magic trick, but I have to imagine she exists somehow, somewhere. I could see a situation where it turns out that maybe Clara was roughing up Jay, perhaps due to a disagreement, and that's where Simone finds him.
Interesting. I like that. I like that. Let's just go with that then.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is we were, as is, you know, commensurate with perhaps our own religious affiliations, a little tough on Jay in the first four episodes. I gotta say, though, Joe, as Simone begins to, you know, nurse Jay, will also simultaneously confront him for, I think, a lot of the stuff that was pulled in the last episode. We see a different side of Jay, in my opinion, specifically when she asks, do you love her? And Jay's delivery, Andy McQueen's delivery of, I love everyone. He does raise his voice, which he immediately apologizes to, but I feel like you see a lot of, like, pain behind his eyes. Now, maybe that's literally from the physical pain he received, but it feels to me like he almost receives this as a bit of his own lack of choice, a theme that is very much a connector throughout this entire show, of whether it's from the big boss or just him being him, he's forced to maintain all of these different relationships, and, like, he almost can't say no to it. That's at least my read of, again, this one look that he gave, which to me feels very different from the kind of strategically manipulative Jay that we got, particularly in episodes 3 and 4.
Yeah, I actually appreciated that, because I feel like whatever incarnation of Jesus Christ this particular actor is playing, there is a burden that's heavy and visible and visceral through the screen. And I think it's now more than ever that you realize, right, he's actually playing Jesus Christ. So I think credit to the actor, credit to the way it's written. But I think it's that key is going to be really, it's going to be a key scene moving forward with his relationship with Simone.
So Simone is going to bring things back as she reveals to Jay, she's here to see a man about a cat. And we go to the location we're going to spend the majority of this episode in the present day timeline, Schrodinger's Island. Now, you were not on the podcast with us, Joe, when we actually saw this original scene. But going back to the island, I mean, there might as well have been a 316 painted on the side of that Zodiac boat, right?
It was hilarious. And all I could think was, they have to go back. I mean, they were. And then I was like, wait, he's back there on purpose. That's an interesting choice. But maybe if the AI is taking over the world, I would also choose to go be Tom Hanks on an island.
100%. So here is Schrodinger, which we saw again in the first episode, also directed by Owen Harris. Also mentioned here that this episode was written by two staff writers on Mrs. Davis, Nadra Widatala and Jason Ning, the latter of whom's credit mainly includes Lucifer, which I suppose does make sense with the whole biblical allegories of it all. But yeah, I was a bit confused at first, and I thought for a second that we were really going timey-wimey here and saying, okay, now did all the events of Schrodinger getting rescued happen after this chance encounter? It turns out not, as you mentioned. We'll find out later that that is not the case. But right now, Schrodinger is a very different man, right? He's very defensive. He says, I said I didn't want to be rescued. And the reason why they came to him is because they noticed a couple of things. First, that he was wearing the British Knight shoes in the hostage video that Clara filmed at the end of last episode. And secondly, doing some fantastic enhance work that only 2023 can bring, they're able to read the collar on Apollo the cat to know that it belongs to Dr. Arthur Schrodinger. How they knew he ended up back on an island, I have no idea, but here they are.
I mean, they have the world at their fingertips. I mean, especially because we know that Wiley is in touch with Mrs. Davis. So he probably could have gotten that information from her, with or without Simone's knowledge.
Well, I think Wiley also has a bit of a different thing on his mind, considering what he has on his tablet.
Yeah. And also, and we'll get to this, I'm jumping ahead, but all I could think about was, how does everything that we've just learned affect his expiration date, mm-hmm. right? To get his wings, is this going to give him a reprieve?
Yeah, and it also brings about this idea, too, of him and Simone being the chosen ones, right? If indeed this theory that Schrodinger has is true, in which Wiley and Simone are the only ones that can, you know, drink from the grail, let alone be the ones to destroy it, does Mrs. Davis know that? And if so, why does she give Wiley that expiration date? I mean, we really have to go back throughout this series of events and think about how much of this was premeditated by Mrs. Davis. You know, when Schrodinger first gets picked up by that boat, they say, you know, she sees all and she knows all. But this is a man that has been off the grid for 10 years and supposedly was pronounced dead. So if that was able to evade Mrs. Davis's radar, unless it wasn't, what else did?
See, my theory is that she totally wanted him there because she knew who his daughter was. And she wanted to keep him at bay. Satellites, drones, all of it. Even though he couldn't see the technology, she was very aware of where he was and only went to get him when, I know he thinks it was because of his signal, but when she needed him.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it does become a little coincidental, right? Almost too much so that that boat responds to the firework and is there the next day. And the fact that he immediately starts to proxy with Mrs. Davis. I agree. It's a little too cute there, much like Schrodinger's cat proper. So yeah, Schrodinger's freaking out a little bit, especially when he hears the name Lizzie. He initially is just going to deny, turn them away. But once he hears Lizzie, he takes a turn in mood, and not for the better. He's going to lament, I tried to spare you, but they brought you right to me. And so he is going to sit them down and answer their questions about Clara. Before I tell you where she is, you must first understand who she is. And her story comes with a warning. If you choose to go through that door, there will be consequences. I mean, Joe, we got to talk about this door symbology, right? You know, three's a trend.
I mean, I keep thinking about the door that the man behind the curtain is, right? In the diner. We're gonna, by the end of episode 8, we're having that door open, right?
Yeah, I have to imagine, or at least a door, right? Because we've had several doors. We have the door in the restaurant. We have the door that Lizzie walked through that led to her getting shot with the arrow. We even have the door in Roman Cafe that I talked about last week as well. Like, doors continually seem to show up. And I think this is that symbology summed up in a phrase. If you choose to go through that door, there will be consequences. This idea of a physical, emotional, mental barrier. If you choose to cross through it, you may find out what's inside. You may solve this mystery, but at the same time, you will suffer some form of consequences.
Right. And I think now that Wiley and Simone know that they were sort of predestined, predetermined, does that change what they do moving forward? I think absolutely. They're more likely to go through doors. You know, he already thinks he has an expiration date. He knows when he's going to die. And, you know, I think now that she knows that everything's been controlled their whole lives, I think this is a game changer. And I think obviously halfway through the season, it's the perfect episode to move the next three. And I cannot wait to see what happens.
Well, let's get into the flashback. So we start in 1982, as we meet a young Clara on Bring Your Daughter to Work Day with her mother, Matilda, played by Katja Herbers. I love the actress, Joe. I hate the character. This is the worst person, probably, who has been on the show.
She's so mean. And even like when she was later on, she's directing her, I thought she was being genuine. What a biatch. I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about it later. When she was doing that, I totally thought, okay, this is an acting exercise. Like, this is something that she clearly fabricated to try to get some emotions out of her daughter. And then she cuts the freaking line at the end of the day, which goes to show that she does not care about her love and dedication.
No, she's a monster, but she's so fun to watch.
Yeah, so Matilda is Clara's mother. What I think is interesting, Joe, is how much Clara's story will remind Simone and us by proxy of her story. Do you think this is going to culminate in some sort of like blood relation, or do you think this is more so just a thematic repeating pattern?
Who hadn't thought about that, like a descendant of descendants. You know what? Anything's possible in the Lindelofian world and the Tara Hernandez world, I should say. But for now, I don't think so, but I am open to that.
Yeah, it's just interesting, right? The idea of don't go in that door. She's going to go into this like vault meeting place later on. There's a lot of repeated phrases between Clara and Simone. So I'm going to imagine that obviously the idea by the end is that she is kind of picking up the torch where Clara dropped it and moving forward with this idea of destroying the Grail. What's also interesting is to slightly tweak an episode title from Damon Lindelof's first series. In this show, all the best cowboys have mommy issues, it seems, between Simone and Clara in particular. They both have a lot of troubles with their cold, emotionally unconnected mother.
That is true. Although I would argue that on Lost, a lot of the cowgirls had mommy issues too. Sun certainly did, and Anna Lucia did. I'm just saying. Kate did.
Yeah.
I just want to point that out because a lot of people talk about the cowboys. The cowgirls also had their baggage. Yes. I think that thematically, the fact that Mother Superior exists is also, it's pretty great. Mm. And I want to see more of Margot Martindale. Mother, the general term, is definitely at play here.
Yeah. Now I'm thinking back to that title. Do you think that's why Wiley is not a good cowboy? Because he doesn't have daddy issues?
Potentially. Yes.
Well, too bad. Although I guess a daddy issue is a pretty big one when your parent is dead. I suppose that's maybe the largest daddy issue of them all.
It's true. And I have to say, sorry, we're of course going to always reference Lost, but when he put on the white sneakers, I'm like, oh, Christian Shepherd. You know, that's just where my brain goes.
Yeah. Do you think that the beginning of Lost should have been a Super Bowl commercial to advertise Nike?
If it was 2023, it would have been.
Yeah, I think at this point, yeah, we'll talk about it. Matilda, very ahead of her time in terms of the amount of visual effects, perhaps some gore that would not be allowed in 1980s television, and also doing the thriller-esque sort of like mini movie commercial.
And $18 million seems like a steal. I don't know, you know, what era this is actually set in, if it's modern day, but 18 seems low.
Yeah, especially nowadays. I'm not sure how much companies are paying, like, let alone production costs, but to get a commercial on the Super Bowl in the first place.
Exactly. But I thought that was genius. When she let us in on the fact that it was going to be a Super Bowl commercial, I thought that was just, it just, the show is very well thought out.
Very much so.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
So, yeah, this is where we get young Clara breaking her way into a place she was told not to go into. I will say throughout this story, we have a perfect peanut gallery of Wiley and Simone, who are serving as fantastic audience analogs, right? And them, like, almost responding a la the Groundlings in a Shakespeare play to the things that are being said. I love Schrodinger's growing resentment towards them for consistently interrupting his story. And Wiley, of course, has to be that one person that we all have in our lives, right? The person who watches a twist-filled show with you and is like, I knew it. Yep, I totally knew that was going to happen. Called it.
Those two totally talk during the movies. I mean, you can tell.
Yeah, 100%. Especially because they feed into each other.
Absolutely.
So much.
I like them for the first time together in this episode. Like, they obviously, it took these actors, I don't know if they worked together before, but I think it takes a few episodes for certainly chemistry, whether romantic or not, to take place. But I really thought they were enmeshed this particular episode. And although also, I didn't realize to this episode that Ben Chaplin is playing Schrodinger.
Yeah.
I was like, I know that guy.
Do you think you just had to get rid of like the big beard
yes.
and all the long hair? And once we were able to see that baby face, we're like, there he is. There's my Chaplin.
Because when we first saw Schrodinger with the beard, I went, that looks like Antonio Banderas, but he is not Latin, so it is not him.
So Clara is going to go where she shall not, and she finds where the Sisters of the Coin meet. The Sisters of the Coin is the official name of these group of pantsuit women that we have been watching for the past couple of episodes, a secret society whose lone goal, supposedly, is for the protection of what is known as the asset, aka the Holy Grail.
By the way, I just realized this, and I'm sure everyone watching realized that the irony that the Holy Grail is actually a Super Bowl.
It's so
literally
good.
Just hit me. You're welcome. I'm now officially with you.
It was so funny. It took me a couple of like minutes to think that through as well, but like it's so on the nose. It's smart, stupid, which I feel like is what this show is going for, right? Where like the comedy is fairly stupid, but like the actual material in it is very heady, trippingly so, that it just perfectly hits that balance, as a lot of the show does with this theming as well. So yeah, this is where Matilda is kind of forced to bring Clara in. Otherwise, she'll kill her. So I'm glad we don't go in that direction. Her death will come much later. And so she's going to explain at least this version now of where the Holy Grail truly came from. Millennia ago, two apostles dueled, which resulted in both of their deaths. The asset was then held in trust by their widows, who then became the first sisters of the coin. And Matilda talks about how this bowl has a life to it, right? It has a temper. If it is not properly cared for, bad things happen. And as is illustrated in the book that Clara is looking through, that includes such natural disasters as the eruption of Mount Vesuvius.
My favorite part is that it also is stinky. Like, it's not just a dangerous bowl, it has an odor.
Well, that's the thing that I love upon rewatch. When you look at the first picture in the book, you're like, oh, all these women are holding their hands to their faces. Maybe this is some sort of religious gesture. No, the bowl just stinks. And so that's why they're actually, plugging their noses at that point. We also get revealed the Articles of Care, which are sort of the Ten Commandments, it seems, of the Sisters of the Coin, as to all these things they need to follow to make sure that the superstitions, essentially, are kept well and full. What's interesting is, as Simone is going to lampshade, they're its mothers. And we'll see later on, I think part of the conflict that happens with Matilda and Clara is that it's a bit of a situation where you're the older sibling and then a new baby comes into the family and suddenly you are, not to say she was ever the pride and joy of Matilda, but like certainly falls on the ladder when it comes to the actual hierarchy of this family.
An inanimate object is definitely her number one child.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I guess given the cataclysmic circumstances, should that child's needs not be met, it makes sense. But still, there definitely is resentment and consternation felt by that older sibling in Clara. And now she gets to enact what a lot of older siblings feel when that baby first comes home, right? Of like, we get to give it back to the hospital. The baby will be destroyed and I'll be the only child again. So Matilda is going to present to Clara this idea of, okay, I had to take a vow to do this. You're not cut out to be a sister, since it requires doing whatever it takes. And Clara will repeat those words back to Matilda, but also throughout the entire episode. Joe, it really seems like whatever it takes is either the Sister of the Coins or the show's like, amen, or, and also with you.
Absolutely. And the fact that the episode ends with that, right? With Simone saying that, not to jump ahead, but you know, until you brought up the could they be related by a bloodline, I hadn't thought of it, but I now I'm kind of with you on that because she repeats it and she knows this is her mission. This is her initiative. I love it.
Yeah. There's also this idea, right, of again, throwing caution into the wind, doing whatever it takes to accomplish your goal. That's certainly something that our main characters are going through at the moment. Certainly, I guess what Mrs. Davis is doing, Jay to a certain extent, with this entire mission in the first place. And it's also a bit of a message of doom, in my opinion. We talk about this a lot on Down the Hatch about how completely throwing yourself into one faith might be a folly just because you are opening itself up to all the consequences therein, much like a door. And I do wonder if this is prognosticating that, hey, the people that are willing to do, quote, whatever it takes to solve their goal, they end up with their head exploded in a Mexican restaurant.
Right. Sorry, I just thought of that imagery. They really go there with the show. I love the budget because this is, it's pretty good head explosions on this show.
100%. Yeah. Amazon Prime, look out. I know The Boys is in its off season, but we have plenty of head explosions to occur on Mrs. Davis if people want that. So now we get a bit of a time jump here. Right now, Clara is older. She is going to be played by Matilda, ironically enough, Olivier, who is going to be resuming the role of Clara for the rest of this episode. And so she has now been like fully brought into the organization. We see a meeting of the Sisters of the Coin. And we find out an interesting fact, Joe, that apparently, in order for the Grail to not cause doom and gloom, at least 1% of the population has to be able to be a part of the Sisters of the Coin. I think Damon Lindelof took a look at the leftovers. It's like, I could round that down about a percent or so. I mean, that's still 75 million people, though, by the mid-80s.
Right. So how does that work? Are there subsets of banker suit ladies all over the world?
I'm not sure, because they also say with the Super Bowl commercial, like, oh, this will get everyone's eyes on it. Is it just a seeing is believing thing that, like, we are all Sisters of the Coin if we just are aware that the Grail exists? Or do, to your point, you have to take a vow, go to Grail Hogwarts, as Simone will say, and like become fully indoctrinated? That seems to be the much harder step to get 75 million people on board.
Right. They're virtual Sisters of the Coin then.
Yeah, exactly. Sisters of the Bitcoin, perhaps.
Oh, goodness gracious.
It's all online. So we now get Matilda's big pitch then, because like we said, little bit of a numbers issue considering where the world population has been going. It was a little bit easier to attain back in the days where the Sisters of the Coin was first founded and there were like 500 people on Earth. Now they need 75 million. And so Matilda is going to go for the Super Bowl. She pitches that they're going to do an advertisement for, quote, a brand with mass appeal, the coolest athletic shoe in the world, one destined to reach iconic status and only gain in popularity, British Knights. And this is something that I'll admit, as like, you know, a child of the 90s, was primarily lost on me. And special shout out to someone like Dr. Amanda Rabinowitz and others for putting this out. Like, British Knights is a thing. It is a predominantly 80s shoe, and I love it. This would be the equivalent of, okay, let's make a commercial about parachute pants or leg warmers, something that will, as a fashion statement, outlive us all.
Absolutely. And the quality of that commercial, it definitely puts it in the camcorder era, right? And I know that she found a camcorder, but it's that filmic quality to it. It's classic, it's iconic. And in the 80s, I was rocking the Reebok white high tops. How about you?
Converse? Rocking the booties, because I was born in August 1989. So yeah, I was going to say the 80s
were
but a short 4 months for me. But I would love to wear some British Knights. They look like very comfortable shoes. Hell, Wiley was able to wear them for like 40 plus hours and nearly won a competition of endurance with them.
That's true. I hope that they market these again. Selfishly, I would love them for my charity auction for Cancer Gets Lost. But I also think that they'd be really cool to wear.
Joe, haven't you learned from this show? Do not get in possession of these shoes. They're going to get Father Hans Ziegler chasing after you, just continually asking where you got the shoes from.
The numbers are bad, Mike, but people still play in the lottery, okay? People don't listen.
100%. Well, speaking of Ziegler, this is where we get his origin story.
I love that he was an apron boy. I love it.
Yeah, he was an apron man. It seems like apron men maybe were like assigned to specific people, that it wasn't like serving the general populace of the Sisters. Because we'll find out that the apron man back from episode 3 was Matilda's current apron man, but it seems like she had Hans for a while, and she is going to conscript him to essentially infiltrate the Vatican as a priest because of largely his genitalia, so that they can embezzle $18 million from the Vatican and scout out some filming locations for this commercial.
I mean, it's totally above board, Mike. I don't know what you're talking about. I wrote on my notes, this is actually really cool. All the women are in charge and the men are sort of at the beck and call and they're wearing aprons. It's a nice reversal of power.
100%. And I think that's a really fun recurring theme of this show is, okay, the men are up front presenting themselves as the face, but the brains are held by the women. That's the entire story of the Sisters of the Coin, right? Was these apostles were fighting for this grail. They were so stupid and pigheaded, they killed each other. Who picked up from where they left off and moved forward with keeping this ancient artifact safe? The women. And I think it's a really fun theme that, as we talked about, gets reflected through a lot of these characters. So Matilda has an entire storyboard down. Who thought she, you know, skews herself as an artiste? She wants to write, direct, and star in the ad herself. But when she is dismissed as too old, who steps up and volunteers but the adult version of Clara? They put it to a vote, and I love this, Joe, on the nose. Of course, the Sisters of the Coin vote by coin.
It's just that cheekiness that I really like about this show, because it could have been anything else, but I was delighted that it was coins. Like, this is exactly who they say they are.
And again, going back to that theme I just mentioned of them being the brains behind the operation, what's interesting to me is the way they vote yes is through tails, not heads. So maybe that's, again, speaking to how they're working behind the scenes. They don't want to be the face. They want to be at the back of everything.
Also, heads are bad. Heads blow off when you mishandle the grill.
Yeah, exactly. If your tail blows off, that's a bit more of a different story. You know, poor Apollo might have that happen, but at least that's fairly replaceable compared to your head.
True.
We flash again 3 years and $18 million holy dollars later. Now, here's something I want to point out, Joe. It seems like Matilda, between young Clara, adult Clara, and then slightly the version that we see of her in the present timeline, maybe it's just the Katja Herbers of it all, but it seems like she barely ages. She has a couple of gray streaks in her hair. So allow me to open up my mental vault and go to my quest log, my cockamamie theory of the week, because it connects to how this episode ends. One of the things the Holy Grail has been mythologized to provide is eternal youth, essentially immortality. My theory is that with the Sisters of the Coin being around the Grail for so long, it granted them that youth and vitality. But because they now are in possession of the decoy, they are starting to show signs of aging.
Gold star, 10 of 10. Love the theory. Hadn't thought of that. It's kind of genius. Does it protect them from dying if they mishandle the Grail?
Yeah, I mean, that's what Schrodinger was referring to later, at least. And like, this cat has aged 35 years and I'm not a cat owner, but I'm pretty sure cats don't live 35 years. So.
And when they do, they're not in that shape. I mean,
yeah, exactly. They're not ambling around.
No, they are not. As a cat owner, I can tell you that 18 is usually the max.
Yeah. So to have a cat live twice that amount seems to indicate to me a state of immortality, which reflects really interestingly on our two main characters.
Okay, maybe the cat lapped a little bit of water out of the bowl. Just saying.
That could be interesting as well. I mean, again, they presented this theory to us of, no, it's the ones who consume the ones who consume from the Grail. But maybe the cat ends up being the clue to this after all.
I love that.
So we're on set for this commercial, and Matilda, predictably so, has turned into a bit of a director-zilla. Despite the fact that now her daughter is her main star of this commercial, she literally tells her, I do not have time to babysit you, while literally babysitting the Grail at the same time. Shuts her out of her trailer, and in comes an ambling Hans Ziegler, now dressed up to the nines, essentially trying to make the pitch to Clara in this moment. I was initially angry when your mom sent me off to the Vatican. I was at first resentful, but now I understand it was a necessary step in realizing my potential. Life is full of doors, like this one, and there are two types of people, those on the outside and those on the inside. And while this is going to get busted up later on with Matilda telling Ziegler, like, get out of that silly costume and get me a tea, he is going to then tell Clara, it is always those who are closest to us whose blade cuts deepest, or perhaps an arrow, Joe.
Absolutely. Is this the scene we're going to get where he reveals who his daughter is?
No, that's going to be later when he actually takes her down to the vault.
Okay. I was confused for a second. I think it's now knowing that, though, looking at that scene. And of course, now, by the way, I need a flashback ASAP with cold-hearted Matilda and Hans. I need to know how that happened.
Yeah, well, also, I need a scene of cold-hearted Matilda and seemingly warm-hearted Schrodinger as well. Was that like opposites attract? How did that end up happening? Because that seemed to be confirmed coitus, whereas Ziegler is very much trying to be one of these many controlling players.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm actually getting much more interested now in these, not that they're side players, but the backstory of not our leads. So I think they're doing a really good job sort of laying the groundwork for the mystery of all of these people.
So Clara is actually going to bite the opportunity of Ziegler's deal, especially after filming is not going so well, right? She's not believable, her performance, according to Matilda. And they have filmed so late in the day that the bowl is starting to stink. So they're going to take a tight five, and she is going to visit him in seemingly the location where JQ landed, this giant repository of shoes. What's interesting, Joe, is that this place was confirmed to be in France last episode, right?
Was it?
Yeah, that's JQ said, oh, he has 200 acres in France and it's off the grid. So clearly he's doing something there that we don't want to. Yet they said, okay, Ziegler, go to Vatican City to scout out filming locations. Now, maybe he went there to like see other vacant plots in Europe. I'm not entirely sure, but that was a bit of a discrepancy that flagged in my mind.
Yeah, I just totally assumed it was in the eBay shoe warehouse underneath the Vatican.
Yeah, well, because JQ had stumbled upon those when they were in France, I think. So it's interesting. I'm unsure as to the geography of it all. But Ziegler is going to present an idea that is so good, Clara's going to do it herself without his help. Swap out this fake asset for a real one. He created a one-for-one recreation of the Holy Grail. He says, let's essentially stick it to your mom, the both of us, and be able to both do that and free the sisters and allow us to get the affection that we deserve. Clara's not necessarily going to dip into the dark side here, more like the deep side in the form of that water. But I do think it's interesting how Clara, much like Simone, again, nowadays, is sort of being used as a piece in this chess game between multiple factors in the form of her mother, her supposed father, and her real father.
Yeah, and it's that sort of fate versus free will situation for both of them. And I really like the parallel storylines between Clara and Simone, actually.
So Ziegler is going to try to go for it in winning Clara over by just saying, I am your father. Now, maybe he could do a cop-out by saying, no, I meant that metaphorically. I am a father, so I guess I am yours because I'm just speaking to your character, the nun, to really get you immersed in your acting, of course. I love it. I love it so much, both this twist and then the twist to unravel this twist later on when we actually find out who Clara's father is.
I mean, I don't know what universe this is taking place in, but maybe Ziegler just really likes Star Wars.
Yeah, that could be a thing as well. I mean, look, this is the mid-80s. I gotta imagine Empire came out pretty
83, 82?
Yeah, so it definitely came out before this time. So maybe they just thought Clara is so cloistered in with the Sisters of the Coin, they don't go out and see major motion pictures. They have better things to do. They can't keep the Grail sitting in a chair for 2.5 hours watching a movie, or else it'll stink up the entire theater. So let me just cop one of the biggest twists in cinematic history.
What's hilarious is if you think about that, that always has to be in motion or else it stinks, right? The Holy Grail, that there are literally Sisters of the Coin assigned once an hour to freaking take it for a walk like a dog.
Yeah. And not only that, though, to disguise it as Simone talked about, their mother, right? To place it in their fake pregnant belly to make it seem like, okay, woman carrying around a bowl, that pings on my radar. Pregnant woman? Nah, just a run-of-the-mill thing you run into every day.
It's actually quite brilliant.
And so we're going to get back to the commercial filming, the climactic scene, right? This is where Ermengarde, the mother superior, ends up dying. And Clara has a line here that she's really struggling with. Out of my love and dedication to you, I vow it will be done. And Matilda is just going to ream her out. How are you so incapable of showing genuine emotion? Gee, I wonder why.
Yeah, the apple and the tree are pretty far apart in this one. I mean, ice cold. And what's interesting is I know we learn later that Schrodinger is her dad, but he just seems to have more of a humanity to him and an empathy, and he seems more of a human being. So I'm glad that we actually get that discovery.
Yeah, well, Matilda's going to insist she's a human being, at least when it comes to the expiration date aspect of it, as she is going to engage in what will become in the future the classic force. She sits her down and says, I have something to reveal to you. I'm dying. I've had these headaches and I went to a doctor and insert, you know, generic vague medical diagnosis here. And it's used as a way to get Clara to channel her like genuine sorrow and heartbreak to see her on camera mother die in front of her and produce a brilliant reading of a line that will ultimately not make it to the screening.
Yes. And it reminded me, she was very Logan Roy. Let's manipulate emotionally all of my children, including the Sisters of the Coin. Let's just manipulate everybody to believe what I believe.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Matilda's entire attitude is essentially F off to everything. She says that, you know, she often doesn't ask for permission to do things, more so forgiveness. And so it does make sense that she has this big cavalier attitude about F your emotions. I'm going to do what I want, and maybe I'll say sorry later on, or maybe I'll say I told you so. Probably the latter. And so now we get to the big scene of Clara having to run on the water with the sneakers. And so Ziegler is going to drop by and just tell Clara, hey, by the way, the decoy is gone. So I guess you moved ahead with that plan. And she's like, nope, absolutely not. I said no. Remember, I held a sword to your throat when you said that you were my father. And so at the end of his rope, Matilda is going to demand her finality ultimately from Ziegler, as he is just going to not so quiet quit. He's going to just absolutely talk back to her, which causes a big ooh to stir amongst the crew. Matilda asks, who do you think you are? And Ziegler says, I'm the one who made this all possible. What thanks do I get? To be your errand boy? I am a priest now, and I am going back to the place where I get the respect I deserve. Now, it's so interesting looking at the Ziegler here, from the Ziegler we especially get to know the previous episode, right? Where his attitude, especially to the Pope, was like, I don't get the respect I deserve here. So I do think it's interesting how we can kind of piece together that he walked off the set, really cemented his legacy in the Vatican, but it turns out that he was pretty much a black sheep there as well.
Yeah, I don't think he was picked for many volleyball games. He just doesn't seem like the guy that you pick first. He seems super insecure, and you know, he wants to please everybody, but I don't know. I don't know what his role is in the end game of the Grail.
Yeah, well, let's talk about how this origin story informs what we've seen so far. Because he is, at least in this moment, going to be our main antagonist moving forward, right? Because he swears to Clara, I'm going to come back at you with the full force of the Vatican. And now we begin to see, like, why he consistently asked about where did you get those shoes? Because it'll turn out these were the lone pair of shoes to escape this shoot, right? These were the shoes that Clara wore. And so he's going to assume, as we talked about last episode, okay, Wiley, you're working with Clara. You know what the tape is, so you know where the Grail is. I still have a question, though. How did he know to be on that train in episode 3? Before he even saw the British Knight shoes, he was on that train when he bumped into Wiley and Simone. How did he know how to be there? Was that a coincidence? Was he told to be there?
Mrs. Davis.
So you think he's also receiving instructions from Mrs. Davis?
Yes.
And conveniently enough, the very thing that Wiley presented in jest in episode 2, right? That Mrs. Davis is working for both us and the antagonist to create a big ploy and make it seem like we're going up against a big bad.
Mrs. Davis got bored and really wanted to create some tension. So yeah, she's working both angles.
Yeah, I mean, going the full Jacob, right? Of like, let's test humanity here. Let me create a little play for them to improvise in and see how the scene ends.
Exactly.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
So Clara is going to make a break for it here. She's going to film the scene, run off the platform into the water, and disappear underneath the surface. And we think for a second, okay, is this GG Clara? But no, perhaps like a Lady of the Lake, Joe, of Arthurian legend, she appears again, coming out of the water, Grail first. But Simone immediately calls out what we were all thinking. She swapped the Grails underwater.
It's kind of genius.
It's a magic trick.
It's a great magic trick. And, you know, she knows magic and Simone knows magic. There's definitely a thread here. Yeah, I love that scene when she ran on the water. That was actually a really cool scene. And the way the cinematography of it, that scene was great.
Yeah, and I think, again, as a representation of her kind of permeating that boundary, right, of opening that door, there is a natural stopping point at the end of this underwater platform. She goes right past it. And she suffers the consequences in, you know, getting soaked and taking a swim, as the DP likes to say. But she is able to gain the benefit of doing what Ziegler had proposed, but being in it for herself, which is to actually walk away with the Grail and damn her mother.
The parallel between Simone and I call her Ginger, the red, Clara, is interesting with the whole, like, now that they've learned who they are and why they are, they're taking matters into their own hands. Like that whole fate versus free will situation. There's a lot of programming that went into both of their lives, and now they are breaking free. And I keep thinking about what you said, Mike, and now I'm obsessed with the fact that I think they're related.
So 26 days, 3 major injuries, 2 production designers, $18 million Vatican dollars, 1 commercial. It is screening day, but it does not go so well, as Matilda is so giddy to present this to what seems to be like a major executive, I guess, general Super Bowl executive. And he's going to say it's a pass from me, because it turns out that Matilda, even though she has a bit of, you know, a cavalier attitude towards life, if I ask for permission every time in my life, she did talk to someone in their office who said that this commercial would be a great idea. The bad news was they talked to Brian, the intern. And so this entire project that they sunk, like Clara, to the bottom of the lake, so much resources, so much of their stock as an organization into, it has now gone up in flames. No commercial.
You know, Matilda couldn't be bothered with the paperwork, okay, and the rigmarole, the red tape, Mike. She just went with it. The intern thing is hilarious. I also just thought that was a BK executive, because he knew that it was an intern who answered the phone. So I don't. I think he was the guy from BK Shoes.
That makes sense. Though I feel like he almost seemed like modernly dressed.
Very.
He did dress a bit like early 90s, though, so maybe it's still evocative of that time period. But suffice it to say, it all goes south. Right now, Clara is going to give Matilda her resignation letter. The cut line was the final straw. Matilda says, "I didn't believe you," in response to the indignation of her line being cut. Clara responds, "But I believed you." And like, that's the relationship in a couple of lines, right? The fact that Clara puts so much stock into this bond, and for Matilda, it's not there. It seemingly never was there, considering how she was probably brought into the Sisters of the Coin before Clara even ended up coming about. So Matilda fires her daughter, and she will reply with anger behind those fiery red eyes. "Out of my love and dedication to you, I vow it will be done." But she will have the last laugh, as Matilda doesn't know Clara ends up leaving with a bit of a severance package in the form of the real Grail.
Yeah, it was a nice little twist there. And I just think Matilda is so interesting. You don't get in modern television a lot of female villains like that. The cold-hearted mother, right? It's sort of a taboo, I think, even in 2023. And all credit to Katja Herbers, too, because she's so watchable. And you know, just she says a lot with her facial expressions. And she's so maternal on Evil. I don't know if you're caught up with that show or watching with it, but no. She's got, you know, 3 or 4 daughters on that show. So it's really interesting to see a complete 360 here.
So now, to your point that we know a bit more about Matilda and at least what she's a part of and what she's striving to do, do you imagine she's going to come back into the picture? Because remember, she got knocked out, sent to the hospital, and then the Sisters of the Coin showed up and squirreled away with her, seemingly faking her death. Do you think she shows back up on the map here in the remaining 3 episodes?
I do. I do. And whether or not it is because of Schrodinger and she finds out what happens to Clara, do you think there's a chance she turns good? Do you think there's a chance that she works with him to do something?
I would reason it's more likely that Schrodinger dies to protect Clara, that like Matilda, maybe not by her personal hand, but perhaps the forces of the Sisters of the Coin join together to take him out as part of some resentment, right? And also maybe to help clean up the trail of, wait, where is the real Grail? Well, let's follow our trail over to England as Clara is going to visit Schrodinger, who has a lovely cat figurine-filled office, and Clara will reveal that he is her father, that she found several communiques between him and Matilda, and that he doesn't even know of her presence until this very moment. And it's a really interesting dynamic, right? They will profess to each other throughout these first couple scenes, like, I'm not really into connection. I only came to you because you're a scientist. We're definitely not going to have a daughterly, fatherly bond resulting from this. And you know, Joe, that that was not going to be the end result.
Actually, it was kind of sweet to watch their journey from that point on, that sort of begrudging relationship and love that bonded between them. And it was probably nice for her to have a father figure who wasn't at all like her mother figure.
100%. That even if he doesn't know her from a hole in the wall, his heart is in the right place. And he conveniently also has several scientific resources that he can utilize to try to destroy this grail once and for all. And the big proving point is going to be shining this Hercules laser, which is the most powerful laser in the world, I believe, at this bowl to determine, okay, it truly is indestructible. And, you know, we're going to talk about the bloody religious magic of it all later on. But this idea of a scientist having to come to terms with the fact that this magical artifact exists, I'm sure was a very conflicted moment for him.
Talk about science versus faith. Hey, it's literally a laser against the Holy Grail. You can't get more science versus faith than that.
Yeah, and faith is going to win out here, at least for a little bit, as Clara and Schrodinger are going to indeed proceed forward with studying this a little bit. I mean, it seems like it's not going to go very far initially. He offers her a room, but then will basically say like, oh, well, I basically invited you out of academic curiosity and nothing more. And then she will say, yes, this is strictly a professional partnership. And then, you know, she is going to end up leaving seemingly after a little while, but not before filming that video for Ziegler. So yeah, what's interesting is the shoes that Schrodinger had on while he was filming this hostage video. It seems to be that these were the exact ones that were given to Wiley, right? Because again, only one pair of these British Knight shoes seemed to escape the filming of this, you know, canceled commercial. So if Mrs. Davis was the one to distribute these shoes, they came from a dead man. Was she like holding on to it? Was, you know, she keeping this in her own proverbial shoebox until the right day came and the right person came across her path? I do wonder how the shoes came from him, you know, leaving them behind, going on this fishing trip, to being pronounced dead, the shoes being given away somewhere, to somehow Mrs. Davis getting a hold on them to specifically use in this instance with Wiley, knowing there's a non-zero chance that Ziegler was going to be in the proximity.
Yeah, I have trouble with that through line. I'm not quite sure about the why Schrodinger had him in the first place.
I mean, I guess he held on to them as sort of like a memento, even though Clara's going to say like, hey, don't wear these in public because I am sort of public enemy number one at the moment. At least it seems like whoever was raiding his place or his next of kin giving away his prized possessions, it somehow wound up on the market. So that continues to be a mystery that we are learning answers to, but still, I think, confounded with questions. We get a little bit of exposition as to the 10 years that these two are going to spend together. So I guess 1991 is when they're going to end things, at least in this timeline. They tried so many things: pneumatic drill, not to be confused with pneumatic tubes, extreme hot and cold, a stampede of elephants in Kenya. And it essentially became like a sort of monthly gathering for them, right? That despite the fact they didn't live together, they would get together pretty much every month to test a new theory. And Schrodinger is going to shrug it off and say, I was just honoring my vow, which feels like a half-handed explanation for like, yeah, but you wanted to hang out with your daughter at the same time.
Exactly. It's very sweet, actually. And my favorite part about Schrodinger, full stop, is that he's a crazy cat lady. His apartment is in a crazy hoarder cat lady apartment.
Yeah, talk about other lies that he's propagating, right? This idea of, well, they just thought it was a joke, and so I'm sort of in on the joke as well. Haha, I'm not that obsessed with cats, don't worry. But, I mean, he's going to take the cat with him on this fishing voyage. Like, clearly this dude, perhaps like Clara, was gifted this thing right in front of him that he didn't want, and then it was able to worm its way into his heart.
I love it.
We're going to go to what seems to be, unfortunately, the final resting place for Clara, as we cut to October 31st, 2001, a rather fortuitous date that we know of previously that will get referred to in this episode. So they are in America because NASA has launched a rocket in the Colorado desert, and they thought, okay, rocket fuel, one of the most powerful, inflammable substances on Earth, maybe that'll be enough to destroy the Grail. And what I thought was interesting, Joe, was after this episode, I went back to rewatch the first two scenes from the premiere because they featured these characters in different light. And Schrodinger ends up constructing his own rocket. And he does this fun little play acting, right, about him being an astronaut on board and calling to Houston. And while obviously he was building his own rocket, I do wonder how much he was channeling that attitude from what would end up being, you know, their last ditch effort to try to find something to destroy the Grail.
Nice callback. Nice catch.
So here they are at Miss L's Tacos, which I love so much as a punny title. And Clara decides, okay, we have tried literally everything except for one thing. It was imprinted on the walls when I found out about this organization. Thou shall not sip. So, ergo, maybe sipping it is what destroys it. And then we're going to have this fun dueling sacrificial lamb moment, right? Where they agree, okay, let's try it. But they're going to go back and forth as to, okay, who is going to drink from it, considering there may be calamitous consequences from it. Clara, though, is not scared. She just didn't want to do it alone.
Nobody does it alone. We've heard that before.
And I wonder if this will prognosticate forward to like a moment where maybe Simone herself will drink from the Grail and she'll say a similar thing to Wiley.
Right.
Like, I think it's interesting how much Schrodinger takes away from this interaction. And perhaps one of the things he does is like, okay, a person who undergoes this Herculean laser effort, should not have to do it alone. If I create several chosen ones, then maybe they'll mount a cooperative effort together. And so one person does not have to essentially die with their head blown off. At least someone else will be in the proximity to get traumatized by it.
God, that's so true. This show makes Lost look like Sesame Street.
100%. Different times. So Clara and Schrodinger are going to play rock, paper, scissors to find out who is going to be the one to drink. Now, what's interesting is Clara is going to say right up front, I'm throwing rock. So she puts it all on him. If you want to take the hit, you know what to do. If you want me to do it, you know what to do. And again, it speaks towards this absence of free will, right? That like a choice has been mandated for you. How you interact with that, that's in your wheelhouse. But again, there's a fun additional 4D chess layer of thinking here where, of course, Schrodinger, knowing that information, is going to go for paper. So then what do? If you want to be the one to drink from the Grail, you throw scissors. And that's exactly what happens.
I know this is going to seem super silly, but I thought of Natasha and Clint in Endgame, Avengers Endgame, right? Of just sort of trying to trick each other into making the sacrifice for the greater good.
Yeah, exactly. And Clara's death is perhaps, I think, a bit more gruesome than what happened to Natasha Romanoff.
Fair.
But she does leave perhaps a bit more of a like colder spy-based family than what the Romanovs do. She is going to drink and nothing happens. But then, almost as if she was traveling through time, her nose starts to bleed. Schrodinger describes it as a, quote, sense of complete peace and tranquility. It's as if she went somewhere. And Simone knows where. This would assumingly be the first interaction, and maybe only interaction, between Clara and Jay, considering it could be coincidentally timed that Clara visits with Jay just as the Pope was asking for his visit, and it all just happened to work out that way. Otherwise, again, as we spoke about earlier, if we're hinting towards like a more repetitive relationship of meetings between Clara and Jay, then therefore her spirit has to live on somehow because her body is not going to live on past a few seconds.
That made me think, does everyone meet with JC right before they die?
That's interesting. Yeah, because we saw Simone was able to invoke his presence by praying. And
right.
In this case, Clara wasn't doing that unless she was like praying in her head. You know, she never seemed to be a religious woman, though she had made many vows, which again connects her to Simone, right? We saw this in the previously on about Jay invoking like Simone's vows of, oh, if you don't do this, you'll be breaking your vows. So maybe it's just if you've made a vow and you're praying to that person, then they will come to visit you in your hour of need. Or if, to your point, Jay just checks in with everybody in the last few seconds of their life.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about, actually.
So she comes back totally at peace. And she smiles at Schrodinger and says, whatever it takes. And then her head freaking explodes. It is far and away the most gruesome thing this show has done.
By far. I had my headphones on and Lisa was in the room and I just started laughing and just going, oh my God, that is so gruesome. And she said, what are you watching? And I said, oh, it's Damon's show. And she's like, okay. Yeah, it was, I was laughing in my mortification.
Yeah, it is an absolute sight. Again, like there was the graphic shot of the woman losing her head from the billboard in the opening episode, but that quickly gets disproven as fake. So this seems to be the real deal, though I think we've settled on this episode, the two of us, right, on Clara may exist in more of a metaphysical sense in some, we haven't even like talked about the idea of an afterlife in this type of universe within Mrs. Davis. And so it could be that Clara lives on as a character, just not in corporeal form.
Sounds like Westworld.
Yeah, exactly. And will Clara take the form of a host, perhaps?
Oh God, I hope so.
Well, what's interesting is, look, let me throw out another big theory. All this happened before Mrs. Davis became a thing. Could it be possible that Clara is the consciousness behind the AI that is Mrs. Davis, and that she died, it was somehow uploaded either magically or scientifically into this database? It needed a personality. And so now this is not Mrs. Davis hunting for the Grail. This is Clara doing so.
I like that idea because, you know, Simone's been assigned to destroy the Grail. Clara wanted to destroy the Grail. And if she is somehow involved with Mrs. Davis, that's why she's fine with the, if you get the Grail and destroy it, then Mrs. Davis gets destroyed as well. It's like her mission would be complete.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. On top of that, the big revelation that gets brought up here, right, is that Clara lived on in A Manner of Speaking. Schrodinger is going to talk about his theory of how when you consume something from the Grail, you die. But the thing that consumes you is able to build an immunity to it, a detoxification of the sort, which would then be able to imbue you with the ability to withstand the effects of the Grail. And so him knowing that, he had to have Clara's legacy live on in some way. And it just so happens that two kids who were put into the hospital that night through two completely coincidental accidents both need their livers replaced, which is the body part that detoxifies what we put into our bodies the most.
I thought that was actually a really brilliant twist. That, in my notes, I went, holy F, that is a great twist.
Yeah, so I guess the question is this coincidental? Or do you think Wiley and Lizzie were handpicked? We talked about how Bo had fixed the rodeo that ended up putting Wiley in the hospital because he needed a liver transplant. I don't think that was the case with Simone. Do you think something behind the scenes, because it obviously wasn't Mrs. Davis at that point, put these three factors in the same place at the same time for the two of them to pick up where Clara left off?
I do not mistake coincidence for fate, Mike Bloom. So yes, I absolutely believe they are chosen and that her mom was in on it.
Yeah, I feel like you have to believe it and they have to believe it at this point. But I'm still holding out some reservation that there's a sizable chance by the end it'll just be a complete shutdown of that theory that they're like, no, you just have to be in the right time in the right place. And there is power in that as well, that like not everything is fated. Sometimes things just happen to fall the way that they fall and how you live your life based on that. So Schrodinger is going to look on to this liver transplant. I will also say, look, as we have established over these four episodes, we are far from experts on Jesus and Catholicism and Christianity. And shout outs to all the people that have wrote in over the past week, correcting us on some of the details we understandably missed, from Simone changing her name to the wedding ring. Thank you all for that, sincerely. But I was reminded a bit of like the cat who ate the mouse who drank the Grail, of transubstantiation a bit. This idea of like, eat of this bread for it is my body, drink of this cup for it is my blood. This idea of like something being represented in the form of something that you eventually consume. Now, I don't think I would go so far as to like they have a little bit of J in all of them, but that was an interesting comparison for me in terms of a religious ceremony and how that might pan onto sipping from the Holy Grail and what that might entail.
I was just thinking about, you know, I'm not a religious person and I'm Jewish, but my wife is Italian Catholic. So I have been to many a Christmas mass with a lot of the nieces and nephews. And when they do the whole body of Christ, they give the wafer. I'm like, what if that wafer contains some DNA that you need to consume to make you, you know, A, B, or C?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. So we have a lot of the Holy Grail demystified for us, but there are still a little bit of questions associated around it, as it should be, as it still is our big MacGuffin. Though, we at least have a destination where we're going. Schrodinger is going to say, after he saw Lizzie and Wiley meet each other and the ramifications of what he did, he decided to go cold turkey on his grail hunt. He realized that his obsession was too great and it was putting others at risk. Hell, his daughter's head exploded from his obsession. And so he decided to, a la Rose at the end of Titanic, right? Just send it back to the depths of the ocean. He goes on a trip with a bunch of marine biologists and he fed the grail to a sperm whale. And the whale went berserk and destroyed the ship, which stranded Schrodinger on the island, as we saw in the beginning of the season. And that's going to be their next stop, right? Schrodinger says, we can track the whale. I'm assuming that, like, the whale must have immediately died after it went aggro. Otherwise, if the grail passed through its system, I mean, listen, it was going to stink anyway from not moving for a while. It was going to stink real, real bad, considering what that entails.
Ew, Mike. Ew. I immediately thought of Moby Dick, the old man in the sea, all these parables that are out there about religion, whales, animals, and the power of water. And I have no idea how they're going to film anything with a whale in the next episode or two, but God, I hope they do.
Yeah, well, the whale will have been pretty expired by this point, right? He's been on the island for 10 years, so I'm not sure where they're going to find this thing or what further gruesome image this show is going to bring about for our eyes to feast upon. Something that should be noted going into our King Arthur check of the week here is the guardian of the Holy Grail, when the Holy Grail was first brought up in, you know, medieval texts, was known as the Fisher King.
Ooh, okay. I like where you're going with this.
So I wonder if they are able to find, like, the final resting place of the Grail being guarded by this fish or king.
And I did note, I laughed when it said there's a tracking device in the grail. So someone obviously had that tech happening.
Yeah, well, that was Schrodinger, right?
Yeah.
That, I don't know, maybe he thought, okay, I'm casting this away for good, but I still want to put a tracker on it just in case. And he was able to detoxify himself and cleanse on this liver of an island where he would be for 10 years. And then, of course, when he gets picked up in this modern timeline, the first thing he has to do is just hop right back on the wagon and ask what happened to Lizzie and Wiley. Now, what's interesting is then he will immediately sequester himself back on the island. As he says, now you two have found me. Whether that's fate or coincidence or the algorithm, I haven't got a clue. But all I know, it's a goddamn sign. And he's going to follow that. And I think that's a really fun summation of, like, his own journey of science and faith, right? Where he's not fully believing in the magical bloody tricks that he talked about with Clara. But at the same time, I think he's certainly open to, like, the forces of the universe possibly working for and against him, as he should, considering what we have seen happen with Mrs. Davis so far.
That's true. I just keep thinking about, where does this show go next? We have 3 episodes left. Does this show end with Wiley dying? He has an expiration date. He's on this mission. I feel like he would sacrifice himself to save Simone/Lizzie. What do you think?
Yeah, the Diley theory is certainly a big one out there. I'm going to imagine it's a fake out, that, like, he reaches his expiration date and then he maybe tragically dies in her arms, but then he comes back to life or something like that. They're able to avert it, because I would imagine that Wiley and Simone have something of a happily ever after. As much as we talk about the depravity of Lindelof shows sometimes, they almost always have, like, a peaceful resolution for a lot of the characters on it. So I would imagine, considering, to your point, the increasing amount of chemistry between these two as their journey has gone along, that it will end in either they both sacrifice themselves, you know, they unite the two parts of the liver to drink from the grail and die subsequently, or Wiley dies trying to save Simone. Maybe she asks Jay for a favor to, like, bring him back to life, and then they do so.
Do you think Jay gets jealous of her and Wiley? Does JC get jealous?
I don't think so. Because
he's got his own things.
Jay has so many other things that he's doing. And I think it'd be a little hypocritical of him, right? To be like, hey, I can have as many relationships as I want, but you're a lone human. You're not allowed to do that as well.
Right.
And I would imagine an amicable separation between Simone and Jay by the end of this. Like, Simone is very loving to Jay by the end of their scene that opens the episode. But like at the same time, I still think she has living rent free in her head. This idea of I'm not the only one and the whole Aaron girl thing from last episode. And so I wouldn't be surprised if this ends up turning into, you know, the journeyman rom-com that we see back in the days when BK was at its heights of, okay, these two were exes. They reconvene, they get back together, and she's able to leave this other guy behind.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of, I know this is going to sound silly and I'm someone who does not ship on shows, but I'm into this love triangle, which is the most bizarre religious / spiritual love triangle you could ask for, but I'm invested in each of them. I think the actor's doing a great job. Although I have to say the guy who plays Wiley, I keep thinking 10 years ago, this is Josh Holloway's role. Like they have this very similar sarcastic, rugged mannerisms, wouldn't you say?
100%. And I think his sarcasm and indignation is very much Josh Holloway, considering how this episode ends, right? Schrodinger is going to pitch, hey, let's go hunt for the Grail now that we're all together. Wiley is incredulous. He's like, I just heard a bunch of stuff that I need to sift through right now. But Simone, thinking through like the journey of Clara via montage, will echo the words, whatever it takes. And so that's how we proceed, is it seems like Schrodinger is now going to be involved. He will now be working with sort of a form of his grandchildren and at least the liver of his child being passed on to these two.
I think it's a great twist. And I look forward to seeing, you know, the three amigos moving forward and seeing how they're going to do what they're supposed to do.
All right, let's get into some of our extras that we like to put out throughout every episode of Mrs. Davis here on Post Show Recaps. The quest log section where we each present a personal theory. I definitely threw a few at the wall this episode, Joe. Any speak out to you this week?
I have to revisit my notes here. At one point, I forget who said it, but only the Vatican has resources to destroy the Grail. Do you remember who said that?
Yeah, so that is, I believe, Ziegler, right? Okay. That's why he wanted the Grail, was he was saying, we can destroy it together, but I have only, the Vatican is the only one that has, I'm assuming, the religious armaments or enough holy water in the world to destroy this.
Okay, so that being said, obviously Simone's going to keep going back to, she has to go back to the Vatican. My theory is somehow Jay leaves the diner and goes with her. And that's the key to actually finally destroying the Grail, but at what cost?
Now, what do you think that presence means? Does he actually take a physical form, or is this him possessing Wiley's body, maybe?
I'm going to guess physical form, and he's not going to possess anyone else.
Interesting. Yeah, that'd be really fun to see, considering that as great as Annie McQueen is, he kind of has been cooped up in that diner set for 5 episodes now. Horse in a Bomb Vest Award for the most insane thing that happened. We got to go with head exploding.
Head exploding. Clara. Yeah, for sure.
And I would say, you know, this might take the cake for most insane thing that's happened on the show so far. Considering that the titular twist turned out to just be Play-Doh, a magic trick on its own. This may be faked in that, like, Clara lives on in some way, but seems very real in the moment.
Yes. I absolutely loved it. I think this show has cojones. I think this show is very bold, and I don't know Peacock or anyone who works there, but I will give them credit for allowing this show to be exactly how I imagine Damon and Tara wanted it to be.
All right, last thing of this week, Hatched, the best Lost adjacent shout out of the week. Joe, is it as simple as us going back to the island to find more answers?
I think so. We didn't have any other really on the nose things happen.
No, I guess we got a different twist on Jack drinking the water from Jacob, Now You Are Like Me. Definitely a different version of Lost ending with Jack's head exploding.
I would not want Hurley or Jack's head to explode. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that would definitely be a twist on everything. And then Ben's like, I'm good. I don't want to leave the island anymore. I'm fine being the number two.
Exactly.
All right, let's get to some feedback here. Now, cards up. A la Vegas, where Lizzie used to frequent. We are recording these ahead of time of the episode's release. Special shout out to Peacock for giving us access to these screeners so we can do so. So we are not going to be able to respond to feedback about episode 5, but the listeners of the Mrs. Davis recaps have sent in some theories for feedback that I do think still applies to this episode, despite the fact that, again, we got a lot of answers here. Let me go to the first one from Aston, who says, I'm really intrigued as to why Mrs. Davis gave Wiley the shoes as a push / setup to meet Father Ziegler and the Pope, or because it's a little nod to Wiley being something of a modern day Templar. What do you think of that latter statement, Joe? Because the commercial, right, was that Clara takes the boot from one of the Knights Templar, splits it open, and the BK shoes are within it. Do you feel like this is not necessarily a way to bait Ziegler, but more so a symbol in her own mind, especially if Clara is Mrs. Davis, to Wiley of like, you are now representing this very late organization?
I think so. I think it's a manipulation tool. And I think it is used to piss off Ziegler. So it's just, it's a really interesting to think about it that way.
Jim Fells says, I'm wondering how much of this is Mrs. Davis sending Wiley and Simone on a path of self-discovery and redemption, et cetera, instead of something that's actually important. What do you think about this? Because we certainly have had the Grail's importance underlined in this episode. But what percent chance do you think that we end this season with them finding the Grail and it turns out, okay, it actually does do nothing, and that this journey was more about you coming into your own as two people rather than actually getting the Grail back?
I don't think it'll be a nothing burger, as you guys like to say. Mm-hmm. I think, and I don't know anything, but I assume they have a second season or an idea for what would be a second season. So I feel like there needs to be a huge twist, but I'd be very surprised if it's that.
Dr. Amanda has a couple of thoughts. She made a note from episode 2 of how we hear from Monty, which is Lizzie's father, that a magic trick is like a marriage, and that ultimately he's going to betray his wife. Knowing that Simone is married to Jesus, we have enough suspicion at this point to see how he will ultimately betray her. Now, you prognosticated, Joe, that this would end with perhaps an in-person meetup between Jay and Simone. But where do you size up the idea that, much like Jay was betrayed back in the day, he would be the Judas in this instance?
I like it. That's a very interesting theory. Nice job, Dr. Amanda.
So her and Nick will also point out this idea of magic and technology and religion, and this central thesis between all three ideas of how you kind of blur your eyes a bit. They're all sort of different shades of the same color. Right? That it requires some form of belief. Some of it is more concretely set in like scientific fact, ergo technology, but a lot of it is done with this illusion of free will and nudging human behavior towards it, right? That your actions are ultimately determined by a quote, higher power, be it an AI determining everyone's actions, be it religion of a higher power determining your actions, or even in magic, right? The magician sometimes quite literally holds all the cards and is the one that is influencing what you see and what you don't see. So I think that was a really astute observation about, you know, we said, as you even pointed out earlier, like, okay, this is science versus technology. But I do think religion should get thrown in there as well, obviously because of the nun and the Jay of it all, but because of the similarities of investing all your free will into something while taking in the consequences.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that through line of faith. You have to have faith to be believing in magic. You also have to have faith to believe in religion. But also, in a way, there are a lot of people who are scared of technology. So it requires a certain amount of faith. I mean, look what's happening right now with AI, right? Mm-hmm. With good reason. And we all watched Westworld and we've all watched the Terminator movies. So there's reason to be a skeptic and a believer for all three of those things.
Let's hear something from the great Ben behind the curtain. He said, just looking at this long protracted flashback sequence to open episode 2, and I can't help but wonder, is Mrs. Davis a magic trick? It feels kind of like the show is telling us that with all the focus on magic. No? Maybe it's literally so, like there is no algorithm, or perhaps it's allegory, calling an algorithm essentially a magic trick. Joe, you were very much in the beginning on under this theory of Mrs. Davis is not a being. It's a group of people that are, you know, doling out the answers to everyone that subscribes to its app. Where are you standing on that theory now that we're over halfway through the show?
I am still sticking with it. I don't think it's one person or one entity. I don't think it's a woman. If it is, I think it's Mother Superior.
Yeah, we'll see. Hopefully you are manifesting a Margot Martindale appearance, considering that she has now only appeared in flashbacks since we have moved on from the convent. Let's finish off our feedback section with a couple of observations from the Upright Man. He starts by saying, twice is a coincidence, three times is a pattern. Simone has supposedly been in a convent for 10 years, but then we see a flashback to 7 years ago when Lizzie first met Jay. Simone reacts to Wiley's mustache with revulsion, but in the flashback, he already has the mustache. Jay asks Simone what she said when he asked her to marry him, but in the flashback, Lizzie asks Jay to get married. To top off all of that, the opening scene is tagged as Paris, France, October 13th, 1307, but now it seems like it was all just a shoe commercial. There's some definite effery going on with the flashbacks, and it's an interesting flip on the narrative convention. Normally, we'll hear people in the present talk about things in the past, and then later get a flashback to show how things actually went down. Cough, cough, lost. Now my gut is that the flashbacks are not to be trusted, which calls into question the entire thing with Simone's magician parents and the crossbow to the gut, and I would add onto that, Joe, the majority of the plot of this episode.
That's very, very interesting. Do you think there is some kind of time travel happening?
Not time travel, but I know I put out there with episode 3 because I also observed the discrepancy in years as well as Simone liking Wiley's mustache back in the day of, okay, maybe there are multiverse shenanigans happening. I'm not completely out on that yet. I could see that being an 11th hour twist, but yeah, I'm not entirely sure. And it does make me hesitant to say, okay, this is the episode where we got all the answers about so many things that are going on. Because how wrong are we going to be about said course of events like 2 episodes from now when it turns out that Schrodinger is in with Mrs. Davis and was lying to them with this, you know, shoehorned in narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are so many twists ahead that will literally blow our heads off, in figuratively.
Well, let's finish with some religious allegory from The Upright Man. He says, speaking of the Da Vinci Code, talking about last episode, that story theorized that the Holy Grail was actually the womb of Mary Magdalene while carrying the offspring of Jesus. If we took that meaning, then finding and destroying the Holy Grail might entail Simone discovering she is pregnant and getting an abortion. Clara was rocking the supposed grail like a baby at the end of the blackmail video. Simone's quest came from, quote, the boss rather than from Jesus. Since the boss and Mrs. Davis may or may not be aligned or the same entity, maybe Jesus wants to be a father, but Mrs. Davis doesn't want to be challenged for worship by a new Messiah. What do you think about this?
Whoever said that, you're my new best friend, because I think that is genius. And I love it. And now I'm totally going to believe that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I dropped this as my theory at episode 4 that Simone was pregnant, but I love relating it back to the Holy Grail of it all, right? And it should be pointed out, the infantilizing of the bull was even more so focused on in this episode. Between, as Wiley points out, like it taking it for walks, nursing it, making sure it doesn't get too fussy. And so it could be interesting if it represents, I mean, there's a hot second, right, where they say, you told us that Clara is here. And, you know, Lizzie says she is and puts her hand on her belly. And I was like, oh, but no, it was more so that she exists in both of us because of the liver thing. But who knows? There may be more than one meaning to that if indeed Simone is pregnant by the end of the season.
Then we'll get a turnip head for season 2.
Oh my God, imagine. The show will have already jumped the whale if they bring in a baby. There's not enough cute things on Mrs. Davis. We already have the cat, but now we need a baby to make people coo. Well, we are certainly cooing about this episode. As we pointed out before, I'm really glad that we were able to quite literally sit down and get a lot of information here. As I pointed out, I'm not sure how much of it will all come out as true in the wash by the end of the season, but at least at the moment, we have a very cogent narrative to go off of. We have an explanation as to this other contingency getting involved in the Grail hunt in the form of the Sisters of the Coin. We found out a lot about the origin story of Clara, yet we are still proceeding forward with like some very fun questions about not only past events, but how this will inform future events. The only thing I'm sad about, Joe, is that there's only 3 weeks left.
I know. But that being said, I love a crisp 8-episode season of a show. 6 to 8 is entirely my wheelhouse. And a lot of British shows do that. They're very crisp and clean with their products that they produce. And I like this model. And I like that they released the first 4 because, like you said, this is not a show that you watch one episode. And like, I think that it'll really get people more interested to be able to watch the first 4 together. And there's a cohesion. And I also like that you come back, by the time you've all seen this episode and listen to us, so many more things are going to make sense. I think I have a better appreciation for the show now in retrospect.
100%. Yeah, we talked about the decision to drop the first 4 episodes all at once. Not only did it work with the bookends of starting and ending with what would be the commercial, but now we have the episode where, okay, You've had a week. You have your theories. Let's debunk them all by sitting down with this old man and him telling us what the quote-unquote truth is. So it ends up working really well from a structural perspective. And we shall see how that translates into next week's episode, again, titled Allison Treasures, colon, A Southern California Story. Joe Garfine, you have been telling quite a story over the past week and change with your Cancer Gets Lost charity auction, which is now officially closed. Is there anything else you want to plug or you want to say about that?
I just want to say to, there are a lot of people who listen to Poetry Recaps who either participated or helped spread the word for our auction. So thank you so much. All y'all are great human beings. You all, everybody. We raised $32,000 for the Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance, which is an incredible amount of money. It was a smaller auction, so I was very, very surprised. I was hoping for 20. We got 32. And the fans who participated around the world have all been amazing. They're paying their invoices. They're spreading the word. And I will tell y'all, a lot of you are Lost fans, and we have a huge Lost online charity auction next year in 2024 to coincide with the 20-year anniversary of the pilot of Lost. We have amassed quite a few very rare items, and we'll be collecting more from the cast, crew, and creatives and getting them signed, and we'll donate all the proceeds, as we always do, 100% to a cancer charity to be determined.
And there's a sizable chance you may have a version of the Holy Grail in your charity next year, right?
I have a few items already that I consider the Holy Grail that will be revealed at some point in early 2024.
Good on you not being a Matilda and really showing your hand as to like what you prefer over what. You don't want to lead to the resentment of the other charity items.
Absolutely. It is mine. No, it's they're safely secured in my Cancer Gets Lost office waiting for 2024.
Well, you don't have to wait until 2024 to get the next episode of the Mrs. Davis podcast, considering that, again, Josh Wigler will be back early next week to talk with Owen Harris, director of this episode of Mrs. Davis, as well as the first two, to get his thoughts on the process of just diving into this absolute wackadoo show. I'm assuming connecting the threads between episode 1 and episode 5 in particular. It's going to be a really great chat. And then before you know it, episode 6 will be out, and so will our coverage of said episode. Of course, if you have feedback as we've combed through this past week and talked about at the end of this podcast, you can reach out in a variety of ways. You can email downthehatch@postshowrecaps.com, or if you're a patron of Post Show Recaps, again, we've got that Discord where people were giving their live reactions to all the ridiculousness of this show, as well as throwing out theories. And we love to hear it. This is a show that is absolute rife, fertile soil for planting those types of seeds. And hopefully we'll be able to read more theories on next week's podcast as well. So that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Mrs. Davis podcast. Follow us all on social media. Joe is at Joe Pinionated. I am at a Mike Bloom type. The in absentia Josh is at Round Howard. And of course, at Post Show Recaps. Let us know your thoughts about this episode and what is to come in the next three. Next time, I'm assuming we go whale watching. Until then, everybody, take care. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.